Hey folks, Zanner here. What a privilege and honor to be here with Tesnua, and especially for Frank with his 30th anniversary. For those of you who don't know Frank, you're missing out. He is one, in my opinion, one of the most genuine, heartfelt people I know. And he does such service for other people. His service at the beginning of the pandemic saved my ass because Frank started the kitchen, which stemmed from the Tesnua meeting at the very beginning of the pandemic. And it was a place where he opened up a Zoom account, and it was a place where we could all spend time together day or night. And he opened up a WhatsApp and added a bunch of people to it. And if anyone ever needed anything, you went to the WhatsApp and just said kitchen, and then people would show up to support you and be there with you. And so I used that as a 911 numerous times at the beginning of the pandemic when I was struggling with my mental health. And it turned into a real family gathering where we would have our meals together. We would do housekeeping together. We would sit and encourage people while they were doing tasks that they had difficulty or anxiety over. I used to go to sleep to that meeting. We had bath meetings together, right? Bath, bed, and beyond, right? Because we were in all different time zones. So depending on where you were either in bed getting ready to go to sleep, you're in the tub relaxing, or you're out and about during the day. And we would sit in that room during the pandemic when we were all isolated for hours on end, days on end, just being there with each other and supporting each other. And it really grew into something special. And that's because of Frank, right? That's what Frank does. That's who Frank is. He's an incredible guy, and I feel honored to call him my friend. And I'm looking forward to your share today, Frank. Thanks.
Thank you, Xander. I was all in work mode. I just got off work an hour ago, and I was going to keep this nice and short and to the point, and then Xander opened me up. But thank you, Xander. Yeah, Xander knows me better than most people in the world, really. People in my life, my family, and friends. I just. For some reason, this place has enabled me to really open up and let people in and get to know people, and they got to know me. Zoom really transformed my life. But yeah, Frank, alcoholic, drug addict. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is an AA talk, as far as I'm concerned. I don't really know any other way to do it. But really, I mean, I've been to CA meetings and NA meetings and CODA meetings and adult children of alcoholics meetings and CODA meetings and SLAA meetings, and I relate to just about everybody. And that what's that one that the brain one that I can't think of right now because I have brain stuff. That one that comes on after this one at 4 o'clock. I've been to that meeting and I relate to them too. So I got sober January 10th, 1995. I was physically addicted to alcohol prior to that. I've gotten exposed to AA at like 17 years old. I had gotten a DUI, and I got in a lot of trouble when I was drinking, and I was very emotionally combustible as a teenager, I guess would be the best way to describe it. And so when I came into AA, I was like, well, this is great. No, this is it. I totally related to everybody. Everybody reached out to me. It made me feel comfortable. And it was totally foreign to anything I grew up with. I mean, I grew up with liars. I learned how to be a good liar growing up, and gamblers and adrenaline junkies. And my family of origin is not a healthy place. Years later, I found out why. There was a big family secret, and I didn't know it, and I was kept in the dark, and that all came to pass, later in life. And everything just seemed to make a lot more sense than up to that point. So yeah, I was just confused, emotionally unstable, suicidal a lot of the times. I just kept drinking and getting in trouble, and I thought this is, when I thought drinking and drugs, I thought this was the answer. This was it. This was how I was going to spend the rest of my life. This is the greatest thing ever. And that's what it was for me. It allowed me to do everything and everything I couldn't do sober. And I never wanted to be sober again. I wanted to be under the influence all the time of something. And that's how I spent my youth, from like 11, 12 on, whenever I could, as often as I could, as much as I could. And once I started getting into trouble, I started trying to control it because I didn't like the consequences I was getting, and I wanted to have a good functioning life and still be able to do what I wanted to do. So I was trying to modify everything, and I tried all kinds of stuff to get it together. And then I decided that I'm going to go in the Marines, right out of high school, and they would straighten me out. I figured that I needed discipline. That was my problem. And so that was my plan. And I just wanted to get out of this little town I was in with all these cops that had nothing better to do but chase me around. And because that's really what it felt like. It felt like they were targeting me because, but I was breaking the law all the time. I was out of control. I was a threat to society, and I needed to be taken out of society. And eventually that's what happened. I got arrested, and I was put in a workhouse for 30 days. And I had been going to AA on and off through all that period. I was court ordered there at one point. I had to go to 7 meetings a week for a year. And I didn't, they had suspended my driver's license, so I had to ride my bicycle to AA meetings. But luckily, there was enough around in my little area that I could go. And I really, AA really embraced me, and I really embraced AA. I didn't have a lot of preconceived notions of what AA was, and the people there seemed to genuinely really care about me. That was something that I was foreign to me. I never really felt that with my family, but these people really, really seemed to. But they knew me. They knew how to cut through my bullshit and to cut through my armor, and to really reach in and get a hold of me. And they really did. They broke through all my defenses and showed me that they cared. And that was totally foreign to me. Yeah, I mean, and I could go on for an hour about the great people I've met in AA and how they've touched me and how they. And this is a good example, Ernie. I'll tell you, Ernie. Now, I got sober in the first time in 1986, and back then they said don't talk about drugs at AA meetings. And this is all in Cleveland, Ohio. That's where I got sober, and it was basically Irish Catholic Alcoholics Anonymous is what they called it, Irish Catholic AA. So that was pretty much everybody there was Irish and Catholic. And I didn't really have a problem with that. I just wasn't a believer. I just couldn't buy. Really, what it came down to was Immaculate Conception. I just could not buy that. I was just like, no, they're just a cover up. They're just covering up. She got pregnant, and they're just covering it up. That, and so that was my, as far as my whole religion thing went. And it was never really pushed too hard on me. They just told me to keep coming back, and I would get it eventually. And I just never got it. It's not that I was against it or I was opposed to it. There was my, that one big sticking point that I just didn't believe that. And and I never got any better. I never got any closer to God. I never, it just didn't happen for me. And I kept waiting, and it, like I said, I wasn't unwilling or against it. I just never got it. It never came. But I didn't really talk about it much. I didn't bring it up. Like, I heard this guy say he was an atheist at a meeting, and my jaw hit the floor. I was like, oh my God, you can't say that here. That's totally against the rules. But so I got sober early on. I was sober 22 months. I met a girl, got her pregnant, and started working 60 hours a week. At that point, I was living in my mom's basement, and I would ride my dirt bike every day and goof off, and I really didn't have a job. I was just, going to meetings at night, hanging out with a bunch of young people in AA and having a good time, and getting sober and really looking into a lot of stuff, childhood issues, and really everything you get exposed to once you get here, all different kinds of therapy and programs, and like I said, I've always been real open-minded to everything. Excuse me. So yeah, I was open to going everywhere and doing everything. I went to a lot of conferences, and I got involved in the young people in AA organizations, and it was really, really the time of my life. It was really, really good. And I started working like 60 hours a week, getting ready for this baby coming. And I met the girl at a meeting. It was, she walked in, and it was like what they say, she had this glow all around her, and I knew she was the one. And I was 19 years old, being a dad, and it to show you where I came from, the kind of upbringing I had. This is like a good example. When I came home and told my mother that I had gotten a girl pregnant, she said, "I'll give you 10 grand, you can disappear." That was her solution to the problem, was I could just go to Mexico, I could go anywhere I wanted to go. She was going to supply me so I could just leave and not throw my life away like that. That was her thinking. I signed up to go in the military. I and quit drinking, and that didn't work out. Going to the military, I got arrested again. In the meantime, it was just I tried to, I really made an attempt not to drink anymore, and I had stopped smoking weed because I had to pass drug tests for the military, and I went out with my buddies one Friday night, and they had a 15 pack of beer, and we were in the front of a truck, and I said, "Nope, I'm not drinking. I just want to get in the military, and I want to get the hell out of here. I'm not drinking tonight." And I lasted about 15 minutes, and I was like, "You know what? Just give me a beer." And then the same thing always happened. That's the arrest I got that night that put me in jail for a month, and the military didn't want me, so now I'm hopeless. Now I got nothing. I have no future, and I was suicidal, working daily back then, and then I started planning it out, and I had a good plan, but I had to go see this counselor once a week or once a month for one of my arrests prior to that, and for some reason, I just broke down to this counselor and told her where I was and what was going on. And I just, and she really saved my life. Really, her name was Becky. She's no longer in the field, but she was there for me that day, and she saved my life, really. And yeah, and then I got, the whole pregnancy thing and all that happened. That was important. I just wanted to tell you that story. I'm working 60 hours a week, and I decide to go out of town with my brothers on motorcycles, and I get the thought in my head that I can party one weekend out of the year and get it all out of my system. I can go out with my brothers, leave the state, I can party, get rid of all the stress I have being a new dad and have working all these hours and all that. So I did. I went out and got hammered with my brothers, the same thing we always did. I came back and I continued to go to meetings, but I didn't tell anybody. So I'm going to meetings, and everybody thinks I have more time than I have, and I'm just really uncomfortable that the special place it had become was no longer that place. So I broke down and told my sponsor, and I was like, "Hey, man, when I went to Indy, I partied." And he's like, "Dude, I got a bag in my car." So it turns out my sponsor had been smoking weed this whole time and not telling anybody. And so out of all the people I could have told in AA, I picked the wrong guy, because me and him, we were just off and running. I was like, "Oh, if he can do it, I can do it." So me and him spent like the next 5 or 6 years. My wife thought I was going to meetings, and I was out smoking weed with him. We'd get high and go golfing. We'd get high and go to the movies. And and then I eventually picked up, let me see, I got a cold, and I started doing cough medicine again. And I had done that all through high school. I had cough medicine in my locker at school, and it was just the perfect combination of alcohol and drugs. And you didn't get caught. Like, if you came in after drinking beers, they caught you at school, but nobody ever caught me on the cough medicine. And eventually I was out with that same pot smoking sponsor, and he took me to a bar down in the flats in Cleveland, and I had this little bottle of cough medicine in my pocket, and I was like, "You know what, screw it, give me a rum and coke." And it was like I never stopped. It was right back to everything all the time, and it almost killed me. I wasn't long before I was drinking around the clock and physically addicted, and I was drinking like 16 beers a day, plus whatever liquor I had, and I was physically addicted. So I know all about withdrawal and the sweats and the DTs, and I would drink in front of the sink because I knew I was going to throw the first one up, and I would drink the flat warm beer that I passed out with the night before because I knew I was going to throw it up. So I would throw up the first beer and then crack a fresh one and start my day, and that went on for too long. And I knew I had had a good education in AA. I knew what was going on, and I knew, this was, and my wife knew too because she had been in AA, and she's like telling everybody, because I came home and announced that I was going to start drinking again, and she's like asking everybody for help, and my family's like welcoming me back. They're like, "Oh, we miss partying with you, man. Come on." So they were happy I was drinking again, and her father was a big drinker, so he was happy to have me drinking at his house. And he said he didn't see anything wrong with it. So she had no support with all that. And then, but she still had some friends that were in AA, and they did try to do an intervention on me at one point. And it wasn't successful, but they sure tried. And so yeah, I was on my merry way, just drinking myself to death, and I knew it, and I didn't care. I was well aware of my situation and my condition, and I just didn't care. I by this point I had three kids, and didn't care. And then I got arrested again. She had called the police on me, so I left the house because I was growing pot in the basement, and I didn't want to get in trouble for that, so I left. And I didn't take my truck, and I didn't take my motorcycle. I took a bicycle because I figured that was the safest thing to do. So I left on a bicycle, and I'm hammer drunk. By this point, I had the state store like 2 blocks from my house. I went to the state store. I got a couple lightweight travelers. I was drinking Jim Beam back then, and I can remember it like it was nothing, like yesterday. And I'm just drinking and riding this bicycle, and trying to stay away from the cops. And they, and I thought I was safe, so I was heading home. And here they are on my front yard, and she sees me coming and points at me. So here they come chasing me on this bicycle, and I'm hammer drunk, and trying to outrun the police on this bicycle. And so we're going through the neighborhood. I've spent 10 years in this neighborhood. Everybody knows me, and here I am, with this police escort on my bicycle, hammer drunk, and it's a lady police officer, and she's yelling to me out the window. She's like, "Frank, we just want to talk to you. Please stop." And I said, "You promise you won't arrest me?" She said, "Yeah, I promise I won't arrest you." So I stopped, and she arrested me. And they gave me they suspended my driver's license because I was operating a bicycle under the influence. Turns out the state of Ohio just removed the motor word out of the motor vehicle code, so they gave me a DUI and a bicycle. But that got me sober. They sentenced me to AA meetings again. And I was like, "Just give me the jail time. AA is the last place I want to go. Don't send me back there." And because I knew the power that was here, and I did not want to stop. And it seemed like I had dug my hole so deep, there was no way of getting out of it. I just wanted to, continue on to the bitter end, which wasn't that far. But I couldn't, I still had, three kids to provide for. I had managed to keep my job and stay functioning through all this, and I wanted to continue that because I did have feel a very big obligation to my children to provide, and so rather than continue and take myself out, I gave up and surrendered, and AA pulled me back in and saved me again, and I was able to get sober, but I still had all this pot that I was growing in the basement, so. I was like, "Okay, I got to get off of that too." And I tapered off the drinking. I just stopped drinking a beer less every day. So I went from like 16 beers to 15 beers to 14 beers, and just weaned myself off like that. And it wasn't like an everyday thing. Some days I'd do 14 beers for like 6 days, and then I'd be able to drop down a little bit less. And so it was controlled, gradual withdrawal from alcohol. And I still had all this pot I could smoke, which really helped get off the booze. So it's like my addiction just needed something to satisfy it. It's like I could quit drinking for 6 hours if I knew I could drink in 6 hours. You know what I mean? My addiction was satisfied if there was a loophole, like I could drink in 5 hours or 6 hours. It would somehow, that's how it worked for me. I don't know. It's like I could satisfy my disease by giving it something. And so that's what I did. I just smoked weed, and then I couldn't stop doing that. I couldn't leave the house without smoking weed. I'd gotten completely off alcohol, and I still had, you know, a big bag of weed. And I came back from a meeting, and I didn't feel right at NAA smoking weed, because like I said, back then they didn't really like any of that. And I knew I just wanted to be 100% here, you know. I didn't want to be behind a veil, because that's what I felt like. I was always behind this veil. I had this thing between me and the rest of the world. It was just me and whatever drug I was on that insulated me from everything else. And that's how I spent my time. I was just insulated from, call it reality, call it whatever. But I never really liked the whole escape from reality terminology. But I came out, and it was a nice sunny day in Ohio, and I knew that I didn't feel like it was a nice sunny day in Ohio. I could lost the ability to feel a nice day, and that bothered me. And so I came home from a meeting, and I flushed a nice bag of Green Bud down the toilet, and that was January 9th, 1995, and I got sober again. And I did what I always did. I ran the meetings. I did 90 meetings in 90 days, and I was active. I made coffee. I chaired. I was secretary. I was treasurer. I had lots of meetings. I mean, I went to usually five meetings a week was my normal. You know, I had two home groups Monday and Thursday, and so I knew whatever happened on Tuesday, I'd be at a meeting on Thursday, and whatever happened on Friday, I knew I'd be at a meeting on Monday. So it was like I was safe, and things got good. And then 5 years sober, I got divorced, and that was really messy. It did not go well. But it was the right thing to do, you know. And a lot of good came from that, on both sides of that. My relationship with my kids actually got better after the divorce, because I wasn't avoiding them in the house because she was there, you know, when I was living there with her. I just wouldn't spend time with them because she was there. And so once we got divorced and separated, my time with my kids was my time with my kids. And, you know, I didn't plan anything. I didn't do any side jobs. I didn't do any work. It was just my time with the kids. Whatever they wanted to do, that's what we did. And, we're still real tight today. We really bonded and came together through all that. It was really good for all of us, you know. And I took them to meetings. You know, I was a single dad, and they went to meetings with me. And I'd bring them coloring books, and they'd sit in the back and have a donut and color pictures. And, you know, they really liked, you know, and everybody in AA was my friend. Those are the people I exposed them to. I didn't like taking them to see my family. I didn't like family functions with them. I would have rather had them at an AA meeting than at a family party, for sure. So yeah, I exposed them to all of that, and now two of them are sober and doing really well, in recovery. You know, and they knew where to come when they needed it, you know. And it's like I had moved away from Cleveland when my son got sober, but all the people that I helped get sober up in Cleveland helped my son get sober. And they, you know, he looks just like me, so they all recognized him as soon as he walked in. They're like, oh, it's little Frank, you know. And so yeah, all my friends up here took care of my son. You know, and how can I express that, you know? And then, let's see, I was down here. I got involved with a girl that used to be sober and started drinking again, and it got really bad. And my ex-wife had cancer, and the kids were going through that, and so I moved back to Ohio to kind of support them and support her. And left that relationship that was down here that was really toxic and volatile, and spent, I think I was up there like 3, 4 years. But you know, and then my wife eventually passed, and it was a horrible, horrible experience, horrible death, horrible cancer was just awful. And but I was there, you know, with the kids through the whole thing, and we got through it, but it was awful. And I had gone up there for surgery at one point, and I stayed at my ex-wife's house, and her and my daughter took care of me post-op. After the surgery, they cared for me, and we had actually had a good relationship again, my ex-wife and I, after everything had happened. And that's what happens here. Things get settled. Things get When you keep showing up, things just work out. And I didn't run, which is what I always wanted to do. I always wanted to run. And so yeah, then the pandemic happened, and I was going to meetings. I'd gotten really mentally ill at this point. I was really isolated. I wasn't going to meetings. I'd moved to a new town, and I didn't get hooked into meetings right away. And I suffered for it. And then I started having a lot of anxiety, and like I could go to a meeting and I could last about 10 minutes, and then I'd have to get up and leave. And a couple of people actually noticed and reached out to me after the meeting. And that's the fucking thing about AA. People notice shit and they come and ask you if you're okay. And that's what they did to me. And they pulled me in, and they got me to a different meeting, and where I made some friends and got hooked in again. And so I was slowly getting out of that isolation, depression, mental illness, and then the pandemic happened, and I'm like, now what the fuck am I gonna do? I was just starting to feel okay, and everything fucking shuts down. And then one of my buddies from my old home group said, "Hey man, have you checked out these Zoom meetings?" And I go, "No." He said, "Yeah, come to Monday. You can see all the old gang. We're all at the Zoom meeting." And I was like, "Cool." And sure as shit, man, it was the greatest thing ever. I got to see all my people from like 20 years ago in the Zoom meeting, because we couldn't go to in-person meetings anymore because of the pandemic. And Ohio took it really serious, man. They were like, everything closed up there. Florida, they didn't. Florida was like, everything was still open down here. The restaurants were open. They didn't take the whole COVID thing serious here at all. But anyway, so I started going to that meeting, and then I got introduced to this free thinker meeting, and they needed help, so I started being active there, and I really got into it. It's like I was at one of the first or second Zoom meetings I was at. This lady got emotional, and I started getting emotional with her, and I was like, "Man, this shit's really working. This whole Zoom thing, it's not like some looking at a computer on a screen. I am like right there with this woman, emotionally attached. So this is the real deal for me." I was just able to be completely present there, even though we were 1,000 miles away, So I got active in this free thinker meeting, and I was going there a long time before I ever heard the word secular. And I was like, "Well, what's secular?" And they're like, "Oh, that's people that whatever, however they describe it." And I was like, "Oh, I just like these meetings, man, because everybody really shares from the heart." Because that's what it was for me. It was like the best of what AA had to offer, without all the bullshit that you had to go through every week. And so yeah, I got active there, and I was going to meeting twice a day, 7 days a week. And boy, I got out of that depression and that mental illness pretty quick. And I got that old AA personality came back in, and I was feeling good. And then a lot of it's like AA is just a big sick family sometimes. And that's what happened. It was just a big dysfunctional family group. And so we opened up to Snua. Jimmy did. Jimmy couldn't get good Wi-Fi signal late at night, so he started a to Snua group, and just because he had better signal during the mornings. And that's how all this started, was just Jimmy having bad Wi-Fi. And it's grown into this huge thing that's like so close to my heart, it's unbelievable. When Xander was talking about two snoo, I mean, this is I believe it's the evolution. There was a need for it, and we created it, and it just all happened naturally. It just was so organic. It's hard to describe. And I knew, like, early on, I knew, I was like, this is going to take me 5 years to process, because there's so much happening here that I can't take it all in. And how Zoom affected all of us so quickly, so intimately. Like Xander was talking about the kitchen, and that was, like, I remember Xander on the edge of her couch, like 15 feet away from the camera in the dark. I remember those days, and look at you now, fuck. And that's the cool thing. It's like, I was, once the meeting started opening back up, I was driving to my Tuesday, or was it Tuesday or Wednesday? Yeah, anyways, I'm on this way to this meeting where I knew like 12 people there that were I was pretty close with. I'm on my way there, and I was like, you know, these people don't know me nearly as well as my Tusnua people do, and I don't know them nearly as well as I know everybody in Tusnua, you know. And that was what the cool thing about this was. We were in each other's houses, hanging out, just like the kitchen, you know, just like hanging out at the kitchen table talking. And it just broke all the barriers, and it just expanded everything exponentially, like the level of intimacy and the trust. And we did have bombers and issues and, you know, security problems, and then readings and what do we say and how do we say it and all that, you know, everything got PC, and it was just really, you know, but we were just growing and healing. You know, I've done a lot of healing here, and a lot of you haven't seen that because I do my own stuff on my own. But like, you know, I'll like Xander and Howard and me spoke at this mental something Palooza. I can't remember what it was called, but it was this cool conference we had on mental illness. And Xander just fucking laid it all out there like I've never heard anybody at any meeting in my lifetime. And it just opened us all up to fucking share deeper and share more and take more risks. And it inevitably it just helped us all get better and get closer. And you know, we just recently had a conference down here, and I tell you, to meet these people in person fucking blew my mind. I wish I would have spent more time with them. At the time I was going through some isolation problems. You know, I was working too. I just celebrated a year at work. And if you would ask me a year and a half ago, if I was ever going to work again, I would have said, no, I can't fucking work. I can't. I need disability. I need, you know, I just can't function out there. And I fucking somehow I did it. You know, I put this work face on, and that's just something I think it's genetic. I think this is part of my ancestry, and it just came out, you know, sort of like the facial hair. Like I looked at myself the other day and I was like, oh my God, I must have an ancestor that has a beard because this looks really fucking familiar. So somewhere in my lineage, somebody that I'm genetically connected to or passed down information from had a beard, because I fucking told you, I was like, this has happened before. And I've had that. I can't tell you how many times that's happened. And I saw it in real life with my great grandson. Here, there's a great story. I'll end with it. My daughter brings her truck over. I'm doing the brakes. Okay. So we're in my driveway. I got the truck jacked up, and I take the lug nuts up, and here comes my great grandson, who's like 3 at the time. And he picks up a lug nut and he puts it on the lug on the stud. Like he's been doing it his whole life. And it was like he didn't see me do it. He just knew that's what he was supposed to do. And I was like, see, it's genetic. It's genetic. It's all passed in, you know, I'm convinced in that we all pass information on genetically. And it would, you know, it's just been really, really cool. And it, like I said, I'm open-minded. I'm open to just about everything. You know, I have this little piece of rose quartz that Julie sent me from Ireland. They brought it over. Tom brought it over from Ireland for the conference and gave it to me in person. And this is in my pocket every day. And I don't know what it does, but I'm open to it. You know what I mean? If it helps, I'll do it. You know, I haven't felt any real negative from it. So, but it was just a fucking beautiful gesture. I mean, here's somebody 3,000 miles away, sends a present along with Tom, and Tom takes the time to pack it and carry it all across through customs and all that shit that you had to go through to get here. You know, these guys traveled through hell to get here, and then there's a hurricane. They all got to travel through hell to get home. And you know, but it was just fucking great what we had. And you know, seeing Tom in the ocean and Shirley on the beach, and Jim and Marcella. God, my brain is just fucking sluggish today. Struggling. But yeah, I've had 4 brain surgeries. I had an aneurysm when I was 40, and it was in the circle of Willis in my brain, which is apparently a really dangerous area. They gave me a 10% chance of surviving the surgery, and let alone walking or talking ever again, just living through it. And that's what they told my kids, and that's what they told my mom and everybody in the waiting room, that I had 10% chance. So it was pretty serious, and I survived it. And then I got a staph infection from the bone hatch they cut out. The bone got staph in the hospital, and they put it back in. And I went back in. They took that out, and you know, I beat staph. And then 8 years later, they put a piece of titanium mesh in there after the bone, and the titanium mesh got MRSA. So the MRSA almost killed me. So they took all that out, and then I went to Cleveland Clinic for that, and then I spent time with the ex-wife, the whole thing. But yeah, I'm much happier with this piece of, they laser cut a piece of plastic in my head, and I'm much more confident of that than that mesh. It was like a window screen was what they put up there to protect my brain. I was just never really confident that it was really strong enough to do the job. And I, you know, we went scuba diving one time in Key West, and I go down about 30 feet, and I started thinking about the pressure affecting the screen of my brain. And I was like, fuck, I gotta get out of here. So that ended my scuba career with the titanium mesh. But like I said, I'm much more confident with this. And but I do have a lot of brain issues. Whatever they did, I lost circulation in some parts of my brain. And you know, I had a left side nerve damage for a long time. I couldn't walk, and I had to walk with a walker, and my shoulder and hip and knee would just convulse involuntarily for a long time. And they said it would get better, and it did. And it's, you know, I hardly ever have those issues anymore. But I do have a lot of brain issues, and that could have been when I had that brain infection. I didn't know that's what it was. So I was getting these adrenaline rushes, full body adrenaline rushes. I'll tell this just for passing on health information. I was getting these full body adrenaline rushes. It wasn't a panic attack. It was a full body head to toe adrenaline rush. And so I thought it was like an anxiety panic thing. So they put me on, what was that stuff called? It was a benzo, Ativan. So they put me on Ativan for my panic attacks. But what it was really was happening was that I had a brain infection, and that MRSA was kicking up. But I was on that stuff for like 3 years. I finally got off of that during the pre-pandemic. That was part of that whole isolation thing. I was getting off Ativan and my antidepressants that really just destroyed my digestion. A lot of bad psychological care here in my experience, and a lot of bad medical care here in Florida. So that too. But yeah, so I got off all that. But I think the benzos really did affect my memory too. I think I did some brain damage with that stuff. They gave me IV a few times, IV Ativan, and it was like a windshield wiper. And I was escalated, and they shot me, and it was just like psh, it just wiped all everything away. Everything was okay, just like that. And yeah, but like I said, I think I did some brain damage. But you know, all things considered, you know, I bought this motorhome up in Ohio. And rebuilt it, and then I had a job lined up in Tennessee, so I was driving there to help this guy build an RV park. And then I got there, and he had gotten into that New World Order thing, and he just got crazy. So that fell through, and I'm like, well, I'm halfway to Florida. I'll just go visit my daughter. I haven't seen her during the pandemic. I haven't even seen my great grandson yet because of the pandemic. And so I drove down here, and I have stayed. So I'm living in a camper, and helping out my brother. My mother's got Alzheimer's pretty bad, and she's starting to get delusional. And I have a daughter and a granddaughter and a great grandson here that I help a lot with. And so that seems to be where I'm supposed to be right now. And I don't know where I'll go from here. Who knows? I mean, this is I can take you guys anywhere with me, which is really cool. You guys are in my pocket worldwide now. So I still got to get my passport thing so I can come up north when the weather's good. But yeah, I talked longer than I thought I was, and I don't know. Thank you all for coming. Thanks for being here. I can't say enough about what this group means to me, and the whole Zoom platform is just priceless to me. And I hope we do this forever. And well, I'll see you tomorrow, where I'll be here same time tomorrow during my Sunday meeting, which we actually did live in person in the conference, which totally blew my mind because I'm watching Tom on my phone, and he's sitting 2 chairs away from me, and it just totally blew my mind because I was so used to seeing Tom on my phone, and I look up and there he is, and he's talking. I'm like, oh, it was just too much. My brain just didn't know what to do. But thank you all for being my friends and really caring about me and supporting me and reaching me out when I do my isolation bouts. And can't thank you enough. That's all. Thank you.